Counter-protest in Miami, Broward College facing budget challenges, and a closer look at reopening public schools. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Black Lives Matter protests and marches continued this weekend, but on Sunday there were also counter-protests. We're going to look back on the news from the weekend and discuss the future for these demonstrations. Also, Broward College let go of more than a dozen counselors. They're also considering dropping all sports. What's the future of the college as budgets tighten amid the pandemic? We're talking to the school's president today. Finally, the governor wants public schools to reopen in the fall. How realistic is that going to be? We'll get a better understanding of the state's ideas for schools and how that meshes with parents, teachers, and superintendents. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, protests over police brutality continued in South Florida over the weekend for the third week in a row. They're calling for an end to police violence against the black community, and many are proposing sweeping reforms to the criminal justice system, including defunding of police departments. But this weekend, things were different. There was another set of people out. There was a law and order rally in downtown Miami. And in Miami Lakes on Sunday, Trump supporters celebrated the president's birthday and carried signs like "All Lives Matter." We're joined now by Aaron Leibovitz. He is a local politics reporter for the Miami Herald. Aaron, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from the Miami Herald, reporter Bianca Padro Ocasio. She's joining us now. Bianca, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bianca, you were downtown in Miami where there were these two dueling rallies. What, paint the picture for me. What was going on?
Sure. So, yesterday was also a celebration for Flag Day and President Donald Trump's birthday. And a group of residents decided to celebrate and at the same time support law enforcement and show outrage at some of the statues downtown that have been defaced in the past week, including the one of Christopher Columbus. So they were mostly, you know, kind of a celebration. About 60 to 70 people who showed up had Trump flags, the American flag, and across from Bayfront Park, there were over a dozen boats that were also, you know, playing music, the national anthem, and just having, it was a pretty positive tone, I would say.
And so, I mean, was it peaceful, though, between the two sides? Because they were close to each other.
Yeah, there was another protest that was going on a little bit, a few feet away from that scene. And it was people who've been protesting in the past several weeks against police brutality and against racism. And they were standing, sitting silently in front of the Christopher Columbus statue, while there were a couple of pro-Trump protesters who were protecting or appearing to protect the Christopher Columbus statue. So there were brief interactions between the two groups, kind of, you know, yelling at each other, but there wasn't really any confrontation or any violence among the two groups. They were kind of doing their own thing separately. And peacefully protesting.
Now, that Christopher Columbus statue, that had been graffitied before.
Yes, and someone painted the hands of the statue with red paint, and there were several symbols, including you know, some graffiti on the base of the statue as well.
And there was one person who did get hurt at the rally, right?
Yeah, so it was almost close to 7:30 or 7:40 p.m. last night. There was a group of protesters, about a dozen at this point, the ones who were protesting against police brutality, and they were blocking off a street on Biscayne Boulevard. And right as you know, they were kind of getting together, about to wrap up, a car refused to reroute to where the protesters were directing cars and just drove straight into the protesters, hitting one woman. She was a 26-year-old woman who basically fell on the ground and had tire marks on one of her legs. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue showed up at the scene fairly quickly, and she was all right, obviously very much in shock at what happened. And I can tell you, I've been out there for the past 2 weeks, and I hadn't seen anyone really get hurt like this. And a lot of the protesters did feel that it was done on purpose.
And did the police find that car?
No one really took down the information of the license plate, but police did show up and they took a statement from witnesses and people who saw it. But obviously everybody was pretty shook at what happened because they were just, you know, peacefully blocking off the road. But every car was pretty much, you know, turning and you know, everyone was kind of coexisting peacefully. So everybody was very shocked at what happened and just asking questions of why, you know, who would do this. But aside from that, everything ended peacefully and people were able to go home.
Aaron, you began your day yesterday at South Point Park where there was a Black Lives Matter protest. What was going on there?
Yeah, so this was actually one of the first couple protests that we've seen in Miami Beach in response to the killing of George Floyd. That's partly because police and state troopers have been blocking protesters from marching across Biscayne Bay and into Miami Beach the past couple weeks. You know, most of these protests have been starting downtown. But this one in South Beach drew, I would say, close to 100 people. They were actually led by a 13-year-old girl named Egyptia Green. She's a rising eighth grader at the Ransom Everglades School. And she also put together the first George Floyd protest in Miami Beach, which was this past Tuesday. She wanted to do it again. The first one only had about 24 people. This one, you know, had close to 100, so it was significantly larger. And they marched from South Point Park onto Ocean Drive, you know, walking along this main tourist strip in South Beach, which is, you know, was a sight to see for people walking off the beach in their swimsuits and, you know, tourists staying in hotels there. And so they chanted, they held signs, and then around Fifth Street, they all stopped and took a knee in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, which of course is the amount of time that the officer in Minneapolis held his knee on George Floyd's neck.
Yeah.
So it was ultimately a successful protest for them, and you know, something that you don't see very often along Ocean Drive.
Then you made your way to Miami Lakes, right? There was a rally in support of President Trump happening there.
Yeah, Miami Lakes could not have been a more different scene. There were, I would say, well over 100 people, many of them waving large American flags, lots of Trump 2020 signs, and really for almost the entire afternoon, from before 2 p.m. until after 5, there were cars driving along Northwest 154th Street in Miami Lakes, honking in support, people chanting. You know, it was billed essentially as a quote-unquote All Lives Matter rally. One of the organizers is involved with a group called Cubans for Trump. And so I think it served a couple of purposes, I think, for the people there. You know, it was certainly a pro-Trump rally. The most common chant that I heard was Trump 2020 and four more years, but also clearly a direct response to the George Floyd protest. It was actually held in the exact same location as a Black Lives Matter protest that had been held in Miami Lakes a week earlier and had caused a bit of a stir in the town.
Yeah. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Aaron Leibovitz and also Bianca Padro Ocasio about the protest over the weekend. You could read more of their coverage on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Bianca, you've been covering these protests about police brutality since they began back in May. But from then to now, what's changed?
So I think the tone right now is a little more about getting organized. You know, how are we going to make these protests sustainable, make sure that they're happening every day? So yesterday, actually, the anti-police brutality protesters who gathered. And I should mention, you know, a lot of the organizers from the group Miami Dream Defenders are often at these protests, but they're not necessarily organizing them every day. So you really see a mix of people kind of getting together. Sometimes, you know, they show up with signs, and you know, other times it's a little bit more robust and organized, but they're just trying to get together and figure out how, you know, what is the kind of change that we are demanding, and how can we get there, and how does our showing up here every day, and even if it's blocking a street for an hour or two, you know, how are we making sure that we continue to have this energy and momentum to go forward. So I think yesterday, one of the organizers split up the group into different, sections. So there were the ones called the Guardians, and they were going to be the ones worrying and keeping an eye on the public safety of the group. Then you have the people who are documenting, you know, from their point of view, exactly what's going on. Then you have, you know, what they call the healers, who are the people watching out for the, you know, personal safety of each protester. So they're figuring out, you know, how are we going to make sure that these protests continue to be organized, they continue to be safe. And as we have noted at the Miami Herald from previous reporting, the protests here in Miami have been fairly peaceful for the most part, and they continue to be, you know, very well organized. And I know that on a daily basis, people continue to show up. So there's definitely still some interest in you know, showing up in person on
you
the
know,
street.
Aaron, we saw last week that the Miami-Dade police decided to ban the controversial chokehold tactic after these protests. Are there any talks or any more changes that are coming from law enforcement in South Florida?
Well, I think one thing that has also come up a lot is the discussion of civilian oversight to review the conduct of police. That's a panel that the Miami-Dade Police Department once had. They no longer do, but it's recently come up again in the past few weeks with a lot of people pushing for this. Actually, just as this interview began, a few county commissioners were holding a public meeting to talk about that possibility. So that's certainly something that that you might see in the coming days and weeks. You know, and then another, of course, is the conversation about defunding the police and sort of the distribution of budgets and funding in South Florida. So, you know, you've seen a lot of activists and other residents, you know, calling in to public meetings and calling for changes in this regard. You know, in Miami-Dade County, police and jails receive 45 cents on every dollar that comes from property taxes and other general funds. And so you're seeing a lot of folks start to talk about these numbers and about, you know, what it would mean to redirect resources away from police and criminal justice and toward, you know, social services and public health.
Yeah. And we have discussed that on this program, as we have on other programs here on WLRN, this understanding when you hear defunding, there's defunding, dismantling. There's a lot of different conversations about, you know, budgets within police departments. Again, we've been talking with Aaron Leibovitz and Bianca Padro Ocasio, both reporters with the Miami Herald, and you can follow their stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Aaron, Bianca, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, Broward College is having to make some big cuts. How is the school going to look after this pandemic's over? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Gregory Adam Hale oversees 63,000 students and 5,000 faculty as the president of Broward College. Over the past few months, the school has been forced to operate remotely because of the pandemic. The administration has needed to make cuts, too, to faculty to address the budget shortfalls exacerbated by the crisis. And they're considering eliminating all sports. And Hale is responsible for navigating the school through this era of social unrest and reimagining as protesters took to the streets in Broward County for the third week in a row, again, protesting police violence. And he joins me now. President Hale, thank you so much for the time.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You know, you have a pandemic that threatens the health of the students and the staff. You have an economic shutdown that's impacting the school's finances. You have protests now, focused on police brutality against Black communities. How are you communicating with those thousands of students and faculty about all of these issues that you're facing right now?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Obviously, it is a unique confluence of external factors that are, frankly, making the lives of our students difficult, and of course, making the lives of our employees difficult. And part of our job, and part of my job, is to ensure that the health of our team members is taken care of to the best that we can, as well as our students, as well as, and I say not just physical health, but I also think about the mental health of our colleagues and students as well. So among the ways that we've gone about communicating around this is really probably about 14 or so weeks ago, when we moved to a remote learning and working environment, we began having town halls almost immediately on a weekly basis. And those town halls would, of course, discuss the management of those challenges that you've just described and I've just described, but also, again, focusing on communicating how we are looking at the future for our institution as well. So at those town halls, we've had in real time anywhere between 700 and 900 attendees. And then those town halls are recorded, and we give the opportunity for individuals who could not attend an opportunity to engage at a later date if they deem appropriate. But to your point, that communication, it must be a cadence of it, which it has been, and it must be transparent, particularly in light of the challenges that we've described.
And what's been the response to those town halls? How do people react within them?
Yeah, the response has been tremendous, whether it's been faculty communicating or staff communicating, the response relating to being informed and being kept abreast of the challenges and how we're managing it has been very well received. And I'll just to dive into a little bit of detail here, when we're talking about the very important challenges that we're facing, such as the community relating to the death of George Floyd, we had a very transparent conversation designed to support our students, in which about 600 or 700 individuals attended the Friday before last, and the transparency has been very well received because the reality is we're all feeling something, maybe to varying degrees, but we all have different bandwidths. But we all know that there's a certain level of empathy that is persisting right now, and we're all trying to help each other through.
You wrote an op-ed in the Sun Sentinel last week, and you detailed the complexities of these protests for you personally, because as a Black man who's faced racism at the hands of police, but also as a leader who works directly with law enforcement on a routine basis, you have a unique perspective. How do you balance those responsibilities with your personal experience?
Yeah. Well, look, part of the reason I serve in the world of higher education, as many people do, particularly at the community college level, is that we are trying to live in a world that creates opportunity for those who otherwise don't see it and don't get it. We talk to our students about the adversity that they face routinely, and despite that adversity, having the capacity, wherewithal, in partnership with us as staff and employees, to support them through every challenge that they face. And so one of the things that I attempted to communicate in my op-ed was the reality that we live to provide equity and equality to the person who may not have the privilege of wealth or resources, or the person who has faced discrimination, whether it be on their race, gender, abilities, or whatever it may be, and being there for them and knowing that they can rely on us to help them move through any challenge that they face, including the ones that they're facing today. Certainly, I and many others have had challenges that we're seeing play out in civil unrest today, But it's still important for us to have an aspiration towards overcoming that. And that is the world of higher ed. That is the world of Broward College, to make sure that we continue to maintain the aspiration for equality, both in education, but in all opportunity, so that they're equally available.
And you know, coming back to, again, the personal side of it, have you taken part in any of these marches or demonstrations, or is that something you can't do?
Yeah, that's something I've not participated in. And what I've really tried to focus on is helping our team internally manage some of these challenges. And, of course, as we look at devising strategies for supporting not only the institution and our folks internally, but the long-term and perhaps external impact we can have, it's something that we are working through now, conversing through now, and in fact, we're working on putting a team together of folks to help us work through some of these challenges.
So we're going through the social unrest, but again, we're still in the middle of a pandemic that's obviously, you know, reshaped education. As you said, like every other institution, you had to go to distance learning. That's pretty much the case for summer, right? Right now, classes are still happening, but people are still having to learn from home.
Yeah, you talked about our 63,000 students. That equates to about 3,500 sections of classes, if you will, and we were able to move about 95% of them to a remote learning environment. And thank goodness we've been able to see a very not only high level of continuity but success as we look at now the outcomes from spring. We are going to remain in a remote environment through the summer, and one of the things that we've recently announced is that we intend at this time to remain in, I'll call it, a primarily remote environment in the fall. And so we think about those courses that have to be face-to-face in order to occur. Think about hands-on programs like automotive programs, nursing lab programs. There are certain courses that need to be in a face-to-face environment in order to have success. And so we intend to move those courses. It's probably about 20% of our courses overall. And while the others remain remote, and we feel comfortable with that, in large part because of the success that we've seen. And, you know, I've already evidenced to you the will of our students and our employees. They understand the import of maintaining a safe environment for our students. And if we can maintain the success, the academic success, while recognizing the import of safety, we're going to continue to do that. And so the plan is to be primarily remote.
What's been the response, though, to the fact that in the fall you're gonna keep the distance learning?
I think the response has been well understood. I will tell you this. Obviously, when we and many others had to go to a remote environment, it was in a very abrupt fashion. And there was, I would say there was probably more hesitancy up front than there has been since. And the hesitancy was in large part because there are a lot of people, staff, faculty, and students alike, who were simply uncomfortable or concerned about success in a remote environment. I've had a chance to talk to faculty members who have said, while they didn't anticipate appreciating this environment, that they have learned to appreciate it and even anticipate that they will continue to leverage remote learning throughout the rest of their faculty career. And so there are certain strengths that we're learning. We're also learning about, as you know, in terms of who we serve, many of our students have transportation challenges. Many of our students have challenges relating to technology infrastructure. And of course, many of our students have challenges balancing the multiple jobs and the kids and the families that they have. And we may have learned about how to address a lot of that. Certainly the time constraints are at least somewhat reduced because we're not asking people to engage in transport to get to us. Certainly, we look at the technology infrastructure, which we are learning to leverage technology in a greater way to support those students, and that's important. And then, of course, the student who had to take two buses to get to us and find time to do that doesn't have to do that in this environment.
What about this, though? Because there's been a pushback nationally, yeah, about universities and colleges just going to social to distance learning, and people saying, well, I don't want to pay full price for that because that's not what I signed up for.
Well, I think it depends on the institution, right? Of course, post-secondary education is an incredibly diverse sector of education. Broward College and the students who come to us, they are, without question, a little bit older than traditional students that you may see at the universities. And oftentimes, those students are very focused on trying to move as quickly as they can from education through a job that will transform their lives. And again, a lot of them are first generation and have a lot of elements to balance. And so many of our students, as you hopefully know, are commuter students. Not many, all of them are commuter students. And so it's not quite the same environment of having to maybe arrive on campus and engage in sporting events or arrive on campus and engage in just events that would otherwise be attractive if you were in a university environment. Our students typically come to school. There are club engagement, but they're really looking forward to moving through and getting their jobs or transferring to a university. And those fundamental elements of our existence maintain, even in a remote environment.
We're talking with Broward College President Gregory Adam Hale, and if you have a question for him, you can always post it on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. So, Mr. Hale, I want to look at the school having to make cuts and looking at their budget challenges. And recently, 14 counselors were let go. And the United Faculty of Florida's Broward College, representing these counselors, recently filed a petition on change.org asking to reinstate them. Now, they're arguing that their role to transition students to online learning is more important than ever before. But these 14 counselors, who are these? What, these folks, what do they do?
Yeah, so let me just back up a little bit, if you will. You know, one of the things that we are very conscious of at Broward College is just the reality of the last decade of the impact on certain financial influences for us. We know that per capita funding from the state is pretty much where it is now as it was in 2009. We know that there have been caps on tuition for over probably about 10 years. We charge about $83 a credit, and that's been static for quite some time, incredibly affordable. And we love that part about ourselves. And then, of course, there continue to be shifting obligations, whether it's increased costs to our colleges relating to the Florida retirement system, whether it's removing dollars from the Florida college system. And then, of course, there is the unique and recent appearance and impact of COVID-19. And so even with all of those things in mind, one of the things that when I came on board a couple of years ago, as I said, we need to get even better at prioritizing what has the greatest impact for our institution. And we had an institution-wide collaboration around understanding that. What's core? How do we do the best we can at engaging in social mobility, moving people from the very bottom to the very top, and using every dollar and resource to do that? And part of that came, obviously, the beginning of that had nothing to do with COVID-19. But part of the reality is that now that we are in this COVID-19 world, we do have this process that we have now concluded around how do we make the greatest impact to our students. And so this is what we looked at, and as you talked about counselors, among the things that we looked at was equity among certain positions. And not to get esoteric around this, but the counselor position was one that was identical to another and had been planned, frankly, a phase-out plan for over 15 years around those positions. There hadn't been anyone hired in that space, but the inequity had a major financial impact. And so...
So you were already planning on getting to move these folks out?
That's exactly... That was part of a plan that probably began about 15 or so years ago.
And so these particular counselors, we're not talking about mental health counselors. What do these counselors do?
Right. So these are counselors, and this ties into what we're doing with some of those resources. These counselors essentially had the role of advisor position for students. And so we've had an advisor position for, you know, the life of this institution. But there was inequity in terms of pay. So what we've actually done is actually hired advisors, or in the process of hiring advisors, and we've asked all those faculty counselors, or let them all know about the opportunity to apply for those roles. So what we've been able to do is open that opportunity, and a number of those folks have applied for the position of academic advisor. So we're actually excited about their applications. Every one of them was offered an opportunity to apply for these positions. We are in the process of examining those applications as well as those positions. So the long and short of that piece is they've been given an opportunity to reacquaint themselves with the college through this application process. And we are in the midst of it and hope to conclude it very soon.
So again, you know, 14, it was, excuse me, it was 14 counselors. Did you have a plan to remove them all at the same time, though? Or is that because of the pandemic?
What the pandemic essentially does for all of us, whether it be Broward College or otherwise, is if there are important financial decisions that need to be made for the health of the institution, it certainly accelerated that. But this was certainly a process that has been in play for some time. And just in the same fashion, as we think about what we're doing with those resources, we've now converted those resources as well as other resources into actually adding 30 academic advisors. And so those advisors, of course, are going to help move our students, particularly in this unique time, through the institution and into great jobs following graduation.
All right. The other thing, too, but even before this, going back a couple of weeks now, is the story about the sports programs.
Yeah.
And first of all, it hasn't been announced. My understanding, right, is there is a meeting this month discussing the future of the sports programs, and that basically you want to end them.
Yeah, well, it's first of all, let me say this is one of the most difficult things to have to engage in, because even if we think about this reallocation of resources for the betterment of all of our students and all of our community, there is no question about the discomfort being created and the difficulties being created by this decision. We have 147 students who love sports, and they have the benefit of doing that at the collegiate level at Broward College. We know that we have employees who are supporting our sports program, and they love supporting those students. But as we look at our own prioritization process, we have to ask whether we can make even the difficult decisions, and this is certainly one of them. And what we're looking at doing with those sports programs, we have about 147 athletes, and we expend about $11,000 per athlete to run those programs. At the same time, we have students who are hungry, and I mean that in a sincere way, some even homeless, about 2,700 of those students. We have about 9,500 students that we could support through enhanced tutoring services, and these are students who can't get through the most challenging classes that we have at Broward College, but they need those classes to succeed. We have 33,000 students who, from an equity perspective, are behind, minority students, older students, and we need to own that that reality and try to fill in those gaps. And of course, we are looking at, probably most importantly, adding about 30 academic advisors to enhance the lives of all 63,000 students at Broward College.
So it sounds like, I mean, you basically, well, first of all, I mean, is it because of the pandemic, or are these budget issues that go before, you know, before the pandemic hit? I mean, when did you start thinking about cutting sports?
Well, it wasn't, just to be clear, it wasn't about cutting sports. It was about looking at the resources that we have and identifying where do we have the greatest impact? And then asking ourselves the very deliberate question, if we identify areas that don't have the desired impact or the greatest impact or influence on making sure that we're moving the most challenged students through our students and into great jobs, then what do we do with those? Are we comfortable saying that we're going to continue to fund them even at the expense of those areas that will have the greatest global impact? So that discussion did not start as a result of COVID-19. That discussion started at the point of saying every dollar that we get, particularly in a shrinking environment when it comes to sources coming from either the state or other areas, how do we make sure that every dollar is having the greatest impact?
So, but when the other thing, too, is this, because now you've got players and coaches who have to think of their future.
Yeah.
And so, you know, transferring to another school if they want to continue their sports career. But did you give them enough time to do that? Was there enough time in the announcement? And again, there's still a conversation coming up June 30th on this, but did you give enough time for them to consider, well, maybe it's time for me to go somewhere else then?
Yeah. So what we're looking at doing, is this, the decision has not been made, obviously, but what we are looking at doing as it relates to our athletes Broward College will have their cost of attending Broward College tuition covered. Many of them already had scholarships, but we are going to maintain those scholarships for any students that were receiving them. We have also proposed that the athletic director be retained for 1 year. That athletic director, in part, will use that time to help support students who don't want to stay with Broward College, and perhaps they want to transfer to another institution to continue their athletic endeavors.
Yeah.
Again, obviously, it's a unique environment, and so it's difficult to say who will continue to play in the next year, but we have retained the AD to do that.
Let me jump in real quick and ask this question. We did get a call from Glenn in Miami Shores. He's asking about adjunct professors and part-timers. Are they being provided compensation and health insurance during this time?
Well, yes. If they're teaching, they're getting compensation. In terms of health insurance, we do not provide adjunct faculty members health insurance. That's never been the case. It's unrelated to COVID-19 or any other influences.
Let me finish with this. What's the future look like? Because colleges and institutions across the country are concerned that they're going to see a massive dip in enrollment applications.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, budget issues as states are losing a lot of money. All these problems piling up on top of you. What's the future look like?
Yeah. Well, look, there's no question about the precarious nature that surrounds us. We don't know what the impact of COVID-19 from an enrollment perspective is going to look like. We know that historically, community colleges in particular have seen upturns in enrollment when there have been declines in the economy, but this is such a unique situation that it's very difficult to anticipate what that looks like currently. As I mentioned, with the economy and COVID-19 having its impact, we are seeing a material decline in enrollment. I think the latest numbers I've seen for summer are about 5.9. down from last year, and the numbers are far more dramatic when we currently look at fall. Now, it's a little early, but at the moment, it looks like enrollment is going to be a significant challenge for us. And for you and your audience members, there's really only two primary revenue sources. It's state funding and enrollment funding, and both of those are on a decline. And what we have to continue to do is what I started this conversation with. We have to ask ourselves, are we prioritizing that which is most important to our students and our community? And that inevitably means making hard decisions, particularly in an environment like ours. And then on the other side of that is recognizing, what are we learning during this time? What are we doing that we can enhance as a result of what we are learning? And make sure that on the other side of this, we are accomplishing our mission despite the challenges, moving students from anywhere they are in the marketplace, no matter how challenged, no matter how old or young or what they look like, and giving them the opportunity, the very best opportunity, to be successful.
A lot of challenges ahead for everybody. Broward College President Gregory Adam Hale. Mr. Hale, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, the state has a plan on reopening public schools. Will local districts go along with it, though? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Governor Ron DeSantis has released a new set of guidelines for schools to reopen in the fall. The guidelines come as school districts around the country are developing a set of plans for the coming August to share with parents and teachers and students. Now, over the past couple of weeks, we've been hearing from school superintendents across South Florida about their plans, and they vary greatly. From alternating days with students in the classroom to complete disinfecting of school buses and cafeterias at the end of each day. We have a web post, by the way, now with our conversations with the Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe County superintendents. Just go to WLRN.org, or you could find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Joining us now is Tampa Bay Times education reporter Jeffrey Solacek via Skype. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So why is Governor DeSantis releasing guidelines for school districts on reopening now? We're talking still a couple of months or so before the fall.
Well, they need some time to prepare, of course. And you have other groups all chiming in with what you should do, whether it was the teachers union or any number of others, parents. And so the governor wanted to put out his statement with his proposal so that way people would know these are the things that we think are important as you get ready, because school is not that far away.
And when do the school districts have to release their plans?
They don't really have a set date that they have to do anything. I've heard districts talking about aiming for a July 1st or maybe a July 14th date where they plan to reveal things. What they're trying to do right now is gather information from the public so that they can get a sense of what people would feel most comfortable and least comfortable about so they can make their plans fit with those.
All right, let's talk about some of these guidelines, what the governor has presented, what the administration's presenting for parents and teachers and students and how to prevent the spread of the virus in schools. What are a couple of the big ones?
Well, of course, there's social distancing, which is going to be hard to do on places like buses and in cafeterias. And so they're talking about things like perhaps taking the cafeterias and turning them into large classrooms and having people eat lunch in their classrooms. And especially in smaller schools and also in elementary schools with the younger children, they're talking about having students stay with the same teacher in the same classroom and not really mix very much. That's one thing that they're looking at. You mentioned earlier, disinfecting of high touch areas is a huge thing. Parents in some areas are very insistent that they want to know, will there be soap? Will there be towels? Things that they have said haven't even been in there in regular times. Now these are super important. And so they want to get those things in there regularly. And one other idea was to limit visitors to schools as well. So having lunch with your kids at school probably will be a thing of the past, at least for a while.
What about, my understanding, these are guidelines, right? These aren't requirements the school districts have to follow.
Absolutely. These are our guidelines. The schools have been told repeatedly that they need to do things that fit for themselves and for their specific needs. And so what might work in Baker County, as the governor likes to say, might not work in Miami-Dade County. And, you know, things like we saw with even going to phase one reopening generally, it happened in different places at different times as people felt more comfortable with it and were able to accomplish things. Some people are criticizing that, though, as saying like, hey, you know, governor, you're just trying to seal yourself off from criticism if bad things happen once the schools do reopen. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. We've heard from, we spoke to all the superintendents in our region, four different superintendents. And the thing that kept coming back up too is this concern about the achievement gap and falling behind, because if students have had to distance learn now for quite some time. But what's the state recommending on how to address that problem?
Well, they are calling this the moral purpose of reopening. As they get back to school, they say they must attack this issue. And so they are talking about things such as what they're calling student progress monitoring, which would be how you keep track of how the students are doing, gather data, and then you are able to make your lessons and create your programs and supports in order to help those students who are farther behind and know where everybody is. They put $20 million from the Federal CARES Act money towards creating this progress monitoring. A big, even bigger amount of money that they're spending, $64 million, they've created a summer recovery program where they are hoping that the students will come in and that the schools will use this money to create programs for catching up. There are other things that they're trying to do, such as train reading coaches and really get everybody back up to speed as quickly as they can, recognizing who needs the help and getting it to them as soon as they can.
What are health officials saying about the recommendations?
Well, they're raising the concerns that you might think that, you know, what if a parent refuses to tell you when your child is sick and it creates what they are considering the perfect situation for the virus to spread out of control? You have tons of kids in these schools. They're going to, by necessity, be close to each other at least sometimes. And it's a possibility that even if the kids don't get sick, they could become the spreaders of this virus. And so it's a big concern that, you know, going back too soon could create another health problem that is trying to go away, or that we hope is going away.
That's an interesting point, too, is that, you know, parents might be hiding information. What have you heard from readers about their concerns about these plans to reopen?
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, and this is the way that some of those surveys are going from the school districts as well. We've heard everything from, please, please, please take my child back. I can't do this anymore. To, there's no way I'm sending them back. Those schools are just cesspools of germs on a regular day. And everything in between. You know, parents have been very frustrated with remote learning. Some of them just want to get back to work or have to get back to work. And, you know, I've talked to kids too, and the kids, you know, they said to me that they've learned how to become independent. They've learned how to be in charge of their own work to a greater degree, but they miss some of the things about school that some of them said they thought they'd never admit to saying, but yeah, they miss school.
And, you know, by the way, Florida, is this among one of the first states to come out with a reopening plan, or where's Florida sit on that?
It really is. I was doing some reading about this just to make sure I had it right, but I only saw a handful of states like Connecticut and Ohio and Texas that have even spoken about going back for summer school plans. And so Florida has really been sort of on the cutting edge of whether they should or shouldn't go back to school. And, you know, the Trump administration has pointed to Florida for its efforts repeatedly. And so they are ahead, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, we're going to have to look at those numbers, I guess.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Solacek, staff education reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. You could read more about Governor DeSantis's proposed guidelines for the schools to reopen in the fall. Just go to WLRN.org. All right. So, Jeffrey, along with the changes proposed on how school is going to look, there are also some big changes to the curriculum. In January, the DeSantis administration released the Benchmarks for Excellent Student Thinking. These new standards are set to replace Common Core in the state, correct?
That is correct. They actually have been adopted by the State Board of Education back in February, and now they're in the process of trying to get them in place so that they'll be ready to go when the time comes, because there is some time built in for preparing the textbooks, preparing the teachers. And you have to realize, remember, look at that. It's called BEST, right? They called it Benchmarks for Excellent Student Thinking. They're calling it the BEST. And so they are hopeful that these will be the best in the nation. They kept saying that over and over again.
So a few weeks ago, a D.C.-based education think tank reviewed the standards by the governor and then released their findings in a report. What were some of the key issues they found with these changes in the curriculum?
Well, what they said was that it's not the best. They said it was a nice acronym, but it didn't really work out. They said that in many ways, there are some very strong things, such as in language arts reading. They said that there are very clear paths for how to learn this material, clear expectations for reading complex textbooks and other materials. In math, they talked about how the topics are handled in a very good way, but at the same time, they called them weak. They said that the language arts standards had nothing really in them for how to read science, which is an important thing to do. And in math, they said they paid so much attention to the process of like doing multiplication that they sort of avoided the conceptual stuff. What does it mean and why is it important? And so in all, they were basically saying that this set of standards could be great, but right now it's not great, and they wouldn't recommend it to other states.
And so what's the state's response to that review?
Well, the state points out quite correctly that the people who were the reviewers all were very involved in writing the Common Core. And so they really sort of bashed those reviewers for being too in bed with Common Core and saying that they had a vested interest in not coming out with a positive evaluation of the new standards in Florida. But they also at the same time thanked those reviewers for recognizing that, yes, the Common Core is finally gone, which was a criticism that some people said that it was not really eliminated in the way that they had hoped. And they're hoping that they can just move forward with it. They are
moving forward with what's the timeline considering this, what we're going through right now?
Well, that's a good question, because right now they have a stated timeline where they're supposed to be developing exams and textbooks next year, which is August. It was supposed to be when kindergarten through second grade would be implementing the new language arts curriculum, and then the following year would be full implementation for all grades, all of the two subjects, math and language arts. But right now we don't know exactly what the plans are, because obviously attention has been placed elsewhere. And some people have said that maybe with this pause, there might be a time to address some of those issues that were raised in that review. So maybe Florida can have better standards than what they had when they first pushed them out.
Jeffrey Solacek, again, staff education reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Jeffrey, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And by the way, again, you can find more of Governor DeSantis' proposed guidelines for schools reopening and also on the best standards at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Monday, June 15th. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to speak with Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. She's a member of the Congressional Black Caucus that sponsored new legislation to ensure police accountability. She's also launching a commission to study societal issues impacting black men and boys. Then we're going to hear from Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Now, his city has been implementing a number of measures to reduce police violence against black communities, including hiring more black officers from within Miami Gardens. He'll join us to discuss that and take your questions. And finally, Friday is Juneteenth, June 19th, 1865, 2 months after the official end of the Civil War. Union generals arrived in Galveston, Texas to inform enslaved blacks of their freedom. Juneteenth has been a day for celebration and reflection about the end of slavery in this country. But the holiday is taking on new meaning, considering everything that we see. How will you be observing Juneteenth holiday? Are there events and discussions we should be aware of? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or you can email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. Well, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Always find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. We love to hear from you, your thoughts about the program. We'll talk again tomorrow.